It's good to be here. Really enjoy coming over. It's been a, let me back up a little bit. The last time I was here, I talked about being at summer camp in 1965 and told a story about that. But the sermonette reminded me of something else in 1965 at summer camp. That was the first and the last time that I used a washboard. That's how we did our clothes for 8 weeks at summer camp that year. We had a big kettle, a wood fire underneath it, and we hauled buckets back and forth, and we all had scrub boards. And that's how we washed our clothes at camp. And then the next year, they got machines, and it went all soft after that, you know. And campers just aren't tough like they used to be. And but I tell you what, that experience made me know that I don't ever want to have to go back to washboards. And that generation. But it's been a little quiet at the office the last couple of days. Beginning on Wednesday, we had several leaving on vacation. Jim Franks is in Guatemala City today for services. He's on a short trip down there. It's interesting. He mentioned it's easier to get to Guatemala City than it is to Portland. It's faster. It's not that far away. It's one of our largest congregations in Cagua, and so it's nice to be able to go down and visit some of the members in Central America. Doug Horchak will be leaving on Wednesday to go to Zambia. He'll be there for, I believe, 2 weeks with the Youth Corps type of project that we have, the service project of helping teach computer skills and English to many of the members there. So it's being a little quiet, but that doesn't mean it's not been busy, because we always have a lot going on. And with the feast coming earlier this year, we're already in full swing on feast preparations. A number of things there. One of the things that you might have heard mentioned already that will be a new feature of the feast this year for the U.S. sites is to have a live Sabbath webcast. We have always had a feast video or a film of some sort, but this year we'll have a live sermon that Mr. Franks will be giving from St. Augustine. And it will go to all of the feast sites live, except for a couple of sites that will have to be on a video delay because of their hall situations. But we're very excited about that. We think that'll have a very good effect. We're getting close to the time where we will be videotaping the feast messages that he will be giving, because most of the sites around the world will not have the live webcast, so we also have to videotape that sermon for them, as well as the introductory sermon. So those things are rather exciting. The next class of Foundation Institute will be starting August the 19th. We have 17 students right now who will be attending for that, and it looks like a very good group, and we believe we're making some very good improvements on the program this year that will raise it up a little bit more. One of our biggest things going on right now in media is the preparation for the launching of a magazine in January of 2014. It will be primarily an e-magazine to begin with, but it's another step forward in a new vehicle for reaching and engaging people. So we are very excited about that. I think you heard not long ago we just passed the 1 million mark for page views. And that's a good statistic. We are more interested in the statistic of unique visitors every month. We are right now running about 70,000 unique visitors every month, and we are looking forward to when it passes 100,000. That's the next benchmark. But Life, Hope, and Truth, the reach and the impact is steadily growing, and we are very encouraged about that. So just a few things real quickly, then I think that's most of the things I jotted down here to comment on, but we are very enthused about the way things are going. By the end of this month, I think the last of the month, 2 Wednesdays from now, will be the last class of Foundation Institute online. Mr. Thompson will be finishing his class, and then after the feast, we will be starting with the Book of Acts. We'll be starting a series of the Wednesday night webcast on David Johnson's classes on the Book of Acts. So, again, a lot going on to try to both feed the flock and preach the gospel. And as always, after services, if you have any questions or comments, I'd certainly enjoy talking with everybody. One of the most haunting questions in the Bible is one that Jesus asked at the end of a parable. Rather than tell you the question, I'd like to take you there. It's Luke chapter 18. In Luke chapter 18, what is known as the parable of the unjust judge, verse 1 tells us the purpose of the parable, which is, he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. So this is one of those parables that tells you before you even hear it what the purpose is. And it's something for humans to think about continually, because losing heart is not an uncommon proclivity among human beings. And for Christians in specific, that carries very serious implications. So he goes on to tell the parable of the unjust judge. And I will skip to the main lesson here in verse 7. Here's the point. Shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. That's a very powerful, emphatic statement. He will take care of things. But then he poses a question that seems almost like an afterthought, something that Jesus tacked on to the end as he turned his mind toward the future. And although there is a guarantee that God will avenge his people, he ends this verse by saying, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? When the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Now, to me, that is sort of a haunting question. Will people believe? Will he find faith on the earth? That's a question we all need to challenge ourselves with on a regular basis. And actually, we need to challenge ourselves on a related question. You could have a slightly different play on words with this and ask, before the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? In our lives, because the need for faith is not just limited to when he returns. Many of us have been in the church for a long time, and we have seen the need for faith many times, whether it's in individual circumstances or sometimes all of us together as one body having to stand and act on faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 6 tells us, without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. That tells us that it's not just faith that he is, in terms of that he exists, but that he is who he says he is, and what he is. Faith toward God is one of the fundamental doctrines listed a few chapters earlier in Hebrews 6. Hebrews 11:6 says, he who comes to God, he who comes to God enters into a commitment to live by the evidence of things not seen. That's in verse 1, a few verses earlier, when it tells us what faith is. If you come to God and enter a commitment to follow him, it is a commitment that tells you that part of your life will be based upon things not seen. And things not seen are hard for humans to deal with. And so faith becomes a vital element of our thinking. Has your faith ever been challenged? Can you think of areas where it is yet to be challenged, perhaps? What about in your own personal life? What about the faith that could challenge all of us together as a body? What are the challenges to faith? You know, it just usually doesn't take too long to realize that following God in this world does not come naturally, does not come easily to fleshly minds. And faith is tried, faith is tested, faith has its enemies. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy 6. Notice what Paul told Timothy in verse 11. But you, O man of God, flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life to which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. We have been called. We have confessed. We've made a confession of the way we want to live our lives. We've made a commitment to that. And now is the ongoing fight of faith. And a fight for faith. Well, let me ask you this, brethren. What is it to fight? What is there to fight? What are the enemies of faith? What are the enemies of faith? Faith does have its enemies. There are probably more than I'm going to describe today, but we're going to cover four fundamental areas of faith, enemies of faith, that Christ identified. Each one is found in the book of Matthew. Four times, Matthew records Christ making a statement, O you of little faith. And each time, he described a different enemy. He describes what makes a person have little faith. But there are four different things. And these core issues are very fundamental for us, very important to keep in mind. And that's what we're going to examine today. Let's go first of all to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew 6, and we'll begin in verse 25. Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Again, a question that is not a question just to gloss over, but to think about, because he's talking about the way we arrange priorities in our thinking. How do we think about life? Then he says, look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? Which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? So why do you worry about clothing? Well, you know, in our country today, we don't have the same worries that some people in other parts of the world do. There are people in some parts of the world who a basic need is clothing, and they find that sometimes hard to fill. Today, most of our worries about clothing is what's the label that's going to be on our rear end, you know, whether it's in style or not. That's our biggest worry. For us, we don't really have a lot of worries, but we do have sometimes misplaced priorities about things like this. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. He doesn't say there won't be some troubles maybe associated with these things. The point is not talking about food and clothing. It's talking about the way we look at life. But four times he talks about worry. Four times he says, do not worry. There is a contrast here over the physical things of life versus is God present with us to help us take care of those things. The phrase, O you of little faith, in the context here of do not worry, tells us there is a connection between worry and the degree of faith in our thinking. I don't necessarily think that Jesus here was condemning people as much as he was simply acknowledging a weakness of the flesh. And he was trying to help us to learn how to think about God and life so the natural human tendencies of thinking do not erode our faith. Because worry is a common issue with human beings. God realizes we're living in a world that legitimately has problems sufficient to be concerned about. That's what he acknowledged at the end of verse 34. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. There will be troubles in life. They're going to come. Tomorrow will bring things to that'll be troublesome. It will. But he says to restructure our thinking because he's involved in our lives now. We have to restructure our thinking, and there is a peace of God that passes all understanding. He doesn't say here, ignore issues. He doesn't say, pretend things don't exist. He doesn't say, don't pay any attention to those bills. He doesn't say, to abdicate your responsibilities, to renege on them. But he does say, worry is not what's going to solve them. And worry is going to erode your faith. It'll take it away. And not only does it take faith away, worry can tend to build on itself. It's a story I heard years ago about a man on his deathbed who was talking about his life. And he made the statement, I've seen a lot of troubles in life, most of which never happened. What was he saying? I've seen a lot of troubles in life, most of which never happened. It meant that through his mind's eye, he focused on a lot of things. He was worried about a lot of things that never happened. But we can allow our minds to go that way. Some people spend a great part of their lives worrying about things that could happen, and it's absolute wastages of time. But more than that, when things do happen, that worry will tend to erode faith. We have to decide how are we going to spend our time. Eroding faith or shoring it up? Christ was trying to help people restructure a framework of how to look at life. And we have to do this, or it will be a condition of having little faith. How do we fight it? Let's go to Philippians chapter 4. We can call this in Philippians 4 what we might call directional thinking or directed thinking. In Philippians 4 and verse 6, Paul wrote, be anxious for nothing. Now, does this say don't have any concerns? Does this say live life in a haphazard way where you don't think about the future and you plan for rainy days and you structure your life responsibly? No, it's not talking about that. It's talking about anxiety. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. There is a guarding of the heart and mind, and there's a guarding against the enemy of worry. And we sometimes have to ask God, please guard my mind. Help me to think. And then he says in verse 8, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Think about these things. That is, this verse is saying we need to think about how we're going to think. We need to think about how we're going to think. I need to make sure that my thoughts go here direct the thoughts here. Part of the good fight of faith that Paul wrote to Timothy is asking God, help me to keep these things in my mind. Sometimes fighting the good fight of faith means we have to isolate ourselves for a while with God, open up to sections like this, and remind ourselves to strive to think this way, and then look through the rest of his word for the supporting evidence of these things. I'm not talking about the Joel Osteen type of approach that just everything will be good if you think positive. No, it is specific, directed thinking on the right things, arming ourselves with God's word, which is full of accounts, full of promises, full of stories of other people's lives, full of thinking about what he has done in our lives before, that give rest to a worried mind. It gives rest to a worried mind. But we must put those things in mind to counter the others and to keep hold of faith. Because when the mind starts going the other way, we don't want to let it take us into a part of our lives where we have little faith. Another very important part of the battle with that particular enemy is to fight it with truth. To fight it with truth. And truth is best established in our minds by starting with the big picture and then working back to where we are right now. Sometimes we make where we are right now, today, that's the big picture. No, it's not. That's the little picture. The big picture is, where is God and what is God doing? Our circumstances will change in life. But what are things that don't change? There are things that don't change. And the foundation of faith is built on things that don't change. That's the foundation of faith. There was a lady who called me one time years ago, and she was in a dire financial condition. When I say dire, I mean it was bad. She was in a very bad way. She was worried. She was fretting. She was consumed with it. And she was panicky. And humanly speaking, it was a very threatening situation. And she just, when I picked up the phone, she just started pouring it all out. You've all had those conversations with people from time to time. They're just pouring out the way they feel about things, and you realize, I just have to shut up and let them, they're going to have to get it all out. They have to spill it out first. And she was spilling it all out. That was one of those times, but as she was talking, it became very clear that her thinking had narrowed into tunnel vision. And that's what human thinking can do. And it was killing her faith. It was killing her faith. So finally, when there was a little pause in the conversation, I tried to grab it real quick and take hold of the conversation. I gently insisted that she stop and answer some questions that I wanted to ask her. And these were progressive questions. And by that I mean they were not random, but they was designed to walk down a certain path of logic toward a conclusion. And the first question I asked her was, do you believe God exists? Well, yes, of course, but that's not the issue. I said, no, just bear with me. Just, do you believe God exists? She said, yes. I said, is the Bible his word? Yes. Did Christ die for you? Yes. Did you die for him through repentance and baptism? Yes. Do you have God's Spirit? Yes. If you died today, do you believe you'd be resurrected and be in his kingdom? Yes. Does God know your situation today? Yes. Did he promise that he would never leave you or forsake you? Yes. Did David say he's never seen the righteous begging bread? Yes. Do you have a congregation here that you attend that you're part of and it's full of friends, brothers, sisters? Yes. Have you been struggling and working hard to do your part? Yes. Do you know how you're going to pay your bills? No. Do you think God can find a way? Yes. As we talked, it was sort of interesting how a calm settled over her. Because the enemy of worry was being beaten back by seeing a bigger picture in life, a different way of thinking, and the tide turned. And at the end of the questions, I told her, I've just written a check for you out of the church's assistance fund. It's already in the envelope, and it's addressed and stamped, and I'll put it in the mail as soon as we finish here. Now, brethren, I realize that solutions don't always come that fast to every situation. Not every problem can be solved by somebody giving you a check. And they don't always come that fast. But thinking can change quickly. The way we think about a situation can change quickly when God orders our thoughts. And when we put our thoughts on a larger picture, the conversation took on a totally different tone. It took on a totally different direction. But what if our conversation had begun with, settled on, and ended with the question, do you know how you're going to pay your bills? If that was the only question we had thought of, if that was the only thing we'd been thinking about, the worry would not have changed at all. But it wasn't the only thing to think about. Worry had consumed the thinking, and worry prevents us from putting God in the picture. And a lack of faith increases. We don't answer the big questions then. Does God know? Does God care? Proverbs 16:3 says, commit your works to the Lord, and your thoughts will be established. Commit your works to the Lord, and He'll take care of your thinking. Your thoughts will be established in a different way. Commit your works to the physical, and your thoughts will bounce all over the place. Your thoughts will be scattered. Your thoughts will be away from God. There's nothing wrong with going to God and being completely honest and say, I have these problems. That's what it says here. Let your request be made known to God. Part of the request sometimes is, help me not to be consumed with worry, in addition to help me pay my bills. I have these problems, but I am committed to following you. I'm not going back. I know you're committed to following me. And then look for examples to trust, examples of trust. Think on those things. Stockpile the stories in life where God has intervened for people. You know, if we gathered back here in this room after church today and sat around and told all of the stories we could think of where God has provided, I wonder how many volumes of books we would fill. There are so many accounts in our lives collectively of things where God has stepped in and provided. He does. And in times of trouble, in times of challenge, those are times when we ought to think on those things. This Christian life ought to be a compilation of experiences, both yours and others, that are not seen as just individual separate stories, but are seen as one story of the way God works with people. They are all individual chapters in an unfinished book yet of what God is doing in His relationship with His people. People who do not connect themselves, anybody in God's church who does not connect themselves with those accounts, and they just bounce from one crisis to the next, will find it difficult to look back and draw strength from the past. They will find it hard to draw evidence, strength from the evidence of God in the past. And yet those are things that we should think about. One more thing, let me mention this. We can help one another in the fight against worry. You know, Malachi says, those that feared the Lord spoke often to one another, and the Lord heard them. Sometimes talking to one another, writing, phoning, speaking, helps people establish their thoughts. It just does. God says your thoughts will be established, and he may use you to help somebody else get their thoughts right. It's important. Number two, Matthew chapter 8. Matthew 8, verse 23. Matthew 8:23. When he got into a boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves. But he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." But he said to them, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him?" So he introduces now fear as another one of the fundamental enemies of faith. Proverbs 29:25 says, "The fear of a man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord will be safe." It's interesting how that proverb contrast fear and trust. And the reason it does is because there's a relationship. There is a relationship. They are related in their effect. Fear tears down trust. And the snare of fear, or rather the snare that fear brings on a person, is a lack of faith. Fear is one of the greatest things that can cause people to panic, to bolt, to run. Let's go to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John 4. In verse 17, we read, "Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love." This weaves a couple of things together, fear and love, and that all has to do with faith, believe it or not. It is based on the love for God and the love of God that is being built in us through his Spirit that is mentioned in verse 17. We may have boldness. Faith is the foundation of boldness, belief, conviction, trust in God. As he is, so are we in the world. Well, how was he? How was Christ in the world? Was he a man of faith? Of course he was. How is he today? Is he a God of fear? No. He has nothing to fear. This tells us something about the way we have to look at the God that we serve. Have you ever thought about how the element of love relates to faith? How those two interact together? Well, think of it first. Think about it in the human level of relationship. In the human level of relationship, in human terms, think about it. The more you love somebody, and the more that you know you're loved by them, how does that affect your trust and your faith in that person? If you really know that you love someone, and they love you, how does that affect your level of trust in that person? Well, you know, there are some people in life that you know you can depend on them to be there for you. You know they would lay down their lives for you, and you know that you would lay down your life for them. You know you are there for them. They know they are there for you. But I would submit that those people you know like that are people that you love and people that you know love you. There is an element of trust and confidence that builds in the relationship of love even between humans. How much more so then with God? We can face circumstances that strike fear into a normal human being, but the more we love God and the more we know that He loves us, the more faith we will have in Him. The more faith we will have in Him, and the more fear is cast out. But fear does involve torment, though, as it says here. Fear involves torment. It bothers the mind. Now, in the last point, I mentioned to you that it's very valuable to help others, to have others around who will help you overcome your worries. At this point, I will tell you that it's very dangerous to have people around who feed your fears. It's very dangerous to have people around who feed your fears. Watch out for people who are always pointing you to the fearful, to the negative. Those people are faith eroders. But what about fear? What does it do to faith? 2.5 years ago, as COGWA was just starting, I had a conversation with someone who told me, they said, you know, there are some people around who are crunching numbers and they're playing with statistics and trying to influence some of the members around with what I would call scare tactics. And their scare point was, you know, this church you're starting to go to and belong to is not going to be financially viable. It's not going to make it. And what are you going to do when it doesn't make it? Well, we ended up discussing that for a few minutes, and we were both on the same page. This person was not bothered by that line of reasoning. They were just sort of telling me that was something going on, and we were on the same opinion of several things. Number one, if you want to crunch numbers, you can make an argument about anything. I could make the case that we would be viable. But the bottom line was, I didn't know for sure, and they didn't know for sure, you know. Sometimes you're in places in life where you just don't know for sure what the future holds. The second, though, is much more important. None of us in the ministry who resigned from our jobs considered number crunching as a basis for that decision making. If that was a reason, as I told this person that conversation, if that was our reason for resigning or not resigning, that would only prove one thing, that you're a hireling. That's not a number crunching is not a basis for faith. It's a basis for fear, if you want to use it that way. And that led to the third and the most important point, that scare talk leads you down a road of reasoning that will undermine faith. Scare talk just leads you down a road of reasoning that undermines faith. Brethren, in life, our biggest concern must always be to be spiritually viable, not financially viable. Being spiritually viable is much more important, and faith is one of the critical areas of determining spiritual viability. We are all going to face situations in life. It may be with health, it may be with finances, it may be in relationships with loved ones, that are threatening to us, situations that are threatening. And living by faith has been demanded of us before, and it will be demanded of us again somewhere down the road. So yes, you can look back on many situations in life and realize we had to step out on faith. You've had to step out on faith. I've had to step out on faith. We all do from time to time. In this particular conversation we were having, I couldn't prove one way or the other in January of 2011 how financially viable we would be in July of 2013. But if that was going to be a basis of whether you have faith or don't have faith, you're sunk already, because that kind of reasoning is wrong-headed to begin with. Faith is based on what isn't seen. Otherwise, it's not faith. I told this person at the time, I said, if anybody is worried about financial viability, then I can tell you one thing that you can't rely on, and that is the bank. We can't go to the bank and have any faith that they'll be there for us. I can just see us going to the bank in January of 2011 and saying, you know, we represent a new startup church, and we don't have an office. We don't know how many members we have. We don't know what our income will be, but we have a great commission to preach, and we need 10, 15 million seed money, and we know you'll be there for us. What was the worst to think about? Getting the blank stare from the loan officer, or the laughter, you know? That there is no, you could never put your confidence in a human being or in an institution at a time like that. You know, they would have no faith in us and would have no reason to have faith in us based on what is necessary for their business. And we would have no faith in them based on understanding their responsibilities. But you know, brethren, there are a lot of things in life that you just don't go to human beings for help on spiritual ventures. We don't go to humans for help on spiritual ventures. We have to go before God with Jesus Christ at our right hand, and we have to learn over time. Do not fear. Don't fear. Fear makes you lose sight of being able to obtain mercy and grace to help in time of need. Number three, Matthew 14. Matthew 14. Here's the case of Jesus set the disciples in a boat. He went into the mountain himself to pray. The boat gets caught in a storm. And Jesus appears to everybody in this horrific storm walking on the sea. We'll start in verse 27. Immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." But Peter answered and said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." Now in verse 27 he says, "Don't be afraid." You might think here, well, this is pointing toward fear, but it really isn't. There's going to be a different lesson here. And Peter, they were in a fearful situation, but Peter more often than not was sort of a fearless type of guy. You could make the point that probably his human fearlessness got him into more trouble than it helped him in. But he's the one who steps up. He's not afraid necessarily. He just says, "If it's you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Well, okay, come." What's a big thing to a human being is a little thing to God. "If it is you." Okay, here comes the test. Christ might have braced himself. What is he going to ask? "Tell me to come to you on the water." Oh, okay, that's easy. Come on. Come on. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Why did you doubt? When they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Doubt means wavering, hesitating. The word in the Greek can be translated standing divided. Having your feet planted firmly in midair. Standing divided. Doubt is the great paralyzer in life. Now, this particular situation, it worked with fear. But it was more than fear. Doubt was there first before fear set in. And that's why Christ hit to the crux of the problem. You lacked faith. Why did you doubt? And I don't know how it all worked out there. When you read verse 33, I in my mind's eye, I sort of see everybody else gathering around Christ and worshiping him. But I can see Peter just sitting off in the corner of the boat with a blanket wrapped around him trying to warm up. And just sitting there quietly thinking and trying to sort through what just happened. What just happened here? It doesn't indicate that Jesus chewed him out. Of course, we don't know the tone of voice that he used, but Christ could have asked a very penetrating question in a still small voice and had it sink in very deeply. He could have looked at him and just said, "Why did you doubt?" And that question is something that you have to take a while to answer, because answering a why question takes you a lot deeper in your mind than answering the what question. If he'd said, "Peter, what just happened?" He'd go, "Well, I asked you to do this, and you called me out, and I saw the waves, and I started to sink, and you saved me." What? Answering what was just describing the event, but Jesus didn't ask him what happened. He said, "Why? Why did you doubt?" I don't think a human can answer that really quickly, because you're being asked to think about yourself and why am I this way? Why was I here a minute ago and I ended up in a totally different place just a little bit later? Why did I do that? Why could I stand on faith and then all of a sudden slip? There's a lot to think about. And when Christ asks us, "Why did you do that?" That's a very introspective question. Why do we doubt? Well, why did Peter doubt? For the same reason we all do. It's ingrained in our human thinking. We live in a world of doubt. We live in a world of criticism. We live in a world of undermining everything that is truth. We live in a world that teaches us to doubt. It's a tool that Satan used from the very beginning in the garden on Adam and Eve. He pushed doubt in their mind about God, what God's motives were, what he was really doing. Satan works and works and works on doubt, continually to throw doubt into the human mind. And that all of that doubt is directed toward doubting God. We don't doubt ourselves nearly as often as we doubt God. Let's go to James chapter 1. James 1. In verse 5. He says here, "If any of you lacks wisdom..." Okay, that's pretty much everybody. I don't think anybody's excluded from verse 5. "Let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him." Well, you have to have faith in that statement, don't you? And immediately he says, "But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind." What is it that drives and tosses human thinking? When it comes to our relationship with God and believing what God says, why do we sometimes find ourselves driven and tossed with human thinking? What is going on in our minds? "Let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord, for he is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways." This is a very strong statement. And it's that way because it's just so contrary to God's nature. God doesn't doubt. He's in charge of all things. He knows all things. He is all-powerful. Now, it talks about wisdom here. But doesn't this apply in everything that we ask of God? Let's look at a great example of where we find ourselves many times in reality. And this is... You know, have you ever struggled with doubt? Have you ever bounced around back and forth? Strong in your thinking when I'm looking at it this way, and then, "Yeah, but what about it?" You know, you can start going just back and forth, and you end up doing what? Nothing. Paralyzed. Here's where faith will put you. Daniel chapter 3. Daniel 3, I'm not going to read the whole long story. We'll get right to the core of it in verse 16 because you know the story basically, I'm sure. Nebuchadnezzar puts up this image and he says, if people won't bow down to this image, you'll be cast into a fiery furnace. Well, you know, this is a real problem. This is a life and death problem that people of God were facing. And you have three young men here, and let's try to correct our pronunciation. It's Shadrach, Meshach, and what? It's not Abednego. It's Abednego. Abednego. Read how it's worded there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, verse 16, here's the important point. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that's the case, if this is what you're going to do, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. You see any hint of doubt or wavering here? No? Did they know exactly what was going to happen? No? You talk about an example of faith. But where did they start? They started with the big picture, verse 17. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from anything. In this case, it was a fiery furnace. What's your fiery furnace? What have been some of the fiery furnaces you've been in? We've all been in our furnaces. Maybe not quite this hot, but we've been in them, haven't we? You know, the big picture is, this doesn't change. This never changes. God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from anything. So that part they knew. Their future was secure. And then they said, he will deliver us from your hand, O king. If we live, we're delivered. If we die, at least we don't have to put up with you anymore. We will be delivered from your hand, even through death. And then he says, but if not, let it be known to you, O king. And here's the other thing. Their present, their future was secure. They said, whatever happens, God will take care of us. And their present was secure too. Because in verse 18, they said, we just don't do that. I don't care. You know, you just need to know we don't do this. There was no waffling. There was no trying to figure out, well, you know, can we find some small print somewhere? Some escape clause? Can we somehow justify it? They were just right up front, weren't they? You know, we won't do that. You know, brethren, life is so much easier, actually, when we set our minds to obey. Hey, I don't break the Sabbath. When we can go there and say, I don't do that, you know. Fire me if you want to. Is that easy? No. I don't necessarily say that this was easy. All I'm saying is they knew where they were, though, and they weren't going to budge. And they were able to stand on faith. When we start waffling, justifying, and rationalizing, doubt comes in, and faith begins to crumble. You know, there's a contrast to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego found in 1 Kings 18:21. I won't turn there. But Elijah said to the people, how long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. If he's Baal, follow him. You know, it doesn't matter what our reasoning is. Sooner or later it comes down, what are we going to do? We either do this or we do that. We either stand with God, we commit to God, or we don't. You know what it says next? It says, the people answered him not a word. Elijah said, make up your mind. Follow God if he's God, follow Baal if he's Baal. And they just stood there. They didn't answer a word. They were paralyzed. they were paralyzed. Their doubt was stronger than their faith. Mark chapter 9. Mark 9. Mark 9, verse 20, story here of a man who had a child who was afflicted with an evil spirit. This child, it's a horrific situation. I mean, you feel horribly for the man. In verse 20, they brought him to Jesus. When he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. So he, Christ, asked the Father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he has thrown him in both into the fire and into the water to destroy him." Can you imagine being a parent and having this happen to your child? And then he said, "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Now, it's interesting. The man said, "If you can do something," and maybe by that time in a trial, you've tried everything, you've been to all the doctors, you've seen all the experts, and maybe by this time in life, you're just used to people not being able to do anything, and he comes to Christ, and his question is, "If you can do anything," and Jesus answers with another "if." Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." The issue was not whether or not Christ could do anything to heal this child. The issue was going to be one of faith. If you can believe, then things are possible. Now, which if of these two ifs, the verse 23 if or the verse 22 if, which one is the bigger one? Which one is the biggest problem? If God can do anything, or if we can believe? In reality, whether we can believe is usually the bigger challenge. It's always the bigger challenge. God can do anything. What follows next is so real and something we can identify with so easily. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." You ever been there? You ever been there? "Lord, I believe. I know these things, but I'm fighting the fight of doubt. Help my unbelief." This, too, is part of drawing near to God. This man was asking for help against the enemy. You know, one of the most fundamental things in fighting the good fight of faith is to ask God for help against the enemy. Help my unbelief. Let's go now to point number 4, Matthew 16. Matthew 16. Beginning in verse 5, when his disciples had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "It's because we've taken no bread." But when Jesus perceived it, he said to them, "O you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves? Because you have brought no bread." The fourth statement here about being of little faith and a reason for it is human reasoning. Human reasoning. Let's read the rest of it. "Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? How is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread? But you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." Then they understood that he did not tell them to be aware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is sort of a little more complex story, isn't it? It's not just open as to like doubt and fear is. It's, he said, you have little faith. And they had little understanding. Their reasoning was shallow, and therefore their comprehension was rather hollow. And why was their reasoning shallow? Why was their reasoning shallow? It's because they put things immediately in the context of what humans do and are capable of doing instead of what God does and is capable of doing. That's why Jesus said, think about the two miracles you just saw. I think on a higher plane than humans think. I'm drawing you to think higher and deeper than humans tend to go. Don't rush to the human conclusions. Think the way God thinks, because it will affect your faith. Faith is a spiritual quality, and as such, it demands higher thinking than humans think. We have to consider first, what can God do? Human reasoning considers, what do humans do? What can we do? That erodes faith. God thinking, God reasoning, is based on a totally different set of abilities and possibilities. Everything changes. Everything changes when God is in the picture. But human reasoning finds that hard to think in those terms. They just weren't thinking the way God thinks. And he related it to a faith issue. Human reasoning is always going to struggle with that. Look at it. Look at a few examples. You miraculously give a man and a woman a son when they are past childbearing capabilities. And then years later, you tell them that he has to sacrifice that same son. That makes no sense humanly, does it? Human reasoning would not have allowed Abraham to carry out and do what God said. You say, we're going to set up a lineage of ancestry that will lead to the Messiah being born. But in the line, we're going to work through a non-Israelite harlot and have her be one of his ancestors. Human reasoning would say, you know, if God had a PR department working for him, his handlers would come say, you know, God, that is not a good idea. You know, this has scandal written all over it, and the press is going to be all over you, and you know how they're going to make you look. You say, we have to defeat this city, Jericho, so here's the plan. We're going to march around it for 7 days. And then on the seventh day, we're going to stop, and we're going to shout real loud. And the walls are going to fall down. Human reasoning would have made Joshua say, are you kidding? So why did Joshua say, okay, let's go? God tells the Israelites, we have to defeat this enemy. He tells a man named Gideon, so here's the plan. You got 30,000 volunteers. That's way too many. Let's take the whole 300. We'll have 300. And our strategy is, our military strategy is, we're going to take these clay pots. We're going to put torches inside. And then we're going to break them and yell with all our might. And those people are going to turn around and kill each other. Human reasoning would not have said, brilliant! God says, you have this problem with a man named Goliath. Let's send out a kid with a slingshot. God tells Naaman, you got leprosy? Bummer. Tell you what. Go jump in the river 7 times, dip yourself 7 times in the river, and that'll fix you right up. Human reasoning would have said, okay, who's next on the approved list of doctors my HMO will pay for? Or God says, I'm going to choose people and call them to build my church. And one of them will be you. human reasoning, you know, if God told each one of us, if God came to you and said, you know what, I'm going to let you call the next 50 people that come into the church, who would you call? Probably not people like us. We could call one or two and solve our financial problems for a long time to come. But you know, God doesn't think the way we think. He's called different people. He doesn't do things the way we would. But you know what? His ways always work. They always work out. Many people have discounted God because they have reasoned him right out of the picture. There are a lot of people today who adapt a very shallow view of reasoning, and they say, well, if God's a God of love, why do we have all this suffering in the world? Therefore, I don't believe him, or I don't believe in him, or I reject everything that he says. And that reasoning is so humanly shallow. Brethren, these four issues are really just a tip of the iceberg in thinking about faith. I hope you'll study it, ponder it, pray about it. Because these four elements, they will devour faith. They are enemies. They are spiritual enemies. And you know, and they work together so well. We've already seen hints of that in the examples that we went to. They play off each other. They pile on. One often leads to the other. And it only takes one: doubt, worry, fear, or human reasoning. And then the others come scooting right on in after it. Worry can lead to doubt. Doubt can lead to human reasoning. Human reasoning can lead to fear. They weave together, they work together in all sorts of combinations. When the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Other parts of the Bible tell us, yes, he will in some, and he won't in others. The determining factor in each situation is how well we wage the good fight of faith. I hope we realize that the greatest enemies that we face, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the greatest enemies we face are not those outside that come at us, but those that lurk inside the human thinking processes: worry, fear, doubt, and human reasoning. But guess what? We have a God that we serve who can help us beat them back and will help us live by his faith.